Hello, this is Randy.
Hi, Randy. It's Joe Burns. How are you?
Hey, good. Sorry, I guess a misunderstanding. I saw that there was a lot of time zone stuff back and forth. Right. My apologies.
Well, no concerns. I'm watching you speak right now to get levels and such like that. Hey, I wanted to ask you up front, do you mind if I post the raw audio? This is something that listeners are asking for. Do you mind if I post the raw audio in addition to the chopped up and the audio I made a show out of?
No, I don't mind. I'm an experienced interviewee and happy to try and make sure that I don't say anything too embarrassing.
Okay. Well, let me ask you. I do an introduction, obviously, and then I do little blips in and out of the two spot breaks. Other than the book, is there anything you wish me to pitch?
Oh, thank you for asking.
Sure.
Yes, we are in the process of building a newsletter called the Making Money with Music newsletter that's entirely focused on money and music. It's something that we really saw as a lack out there in the market. Mm-hmm. And we want to help musicians make more money, and it's our best way to stay in communication with them and continue to send the latest ideas. Because as you said in many of your initial questions, how do you keep up? How do you keep with the latest? So
does one get to it?
MakingMoneyWithMusic.com/newsletter. Or if you just go to MakingMoneyWithMusic.com, you'll find your way to the newsletter. It's right there.
Okay, I'm writing this down as quickly as I can.
No problem.
/newsletter. And by the way, as soon as this is over, I'm going to head out and sign myself up for it. That interests me to no end. So.
Oh, fantastic.
Okay.
Look, yeah, great.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Anything else you want pitched?
Mostly, no, just the book and the newsletter. We're going to be traveling around and speaking, but I don't know, your podcasters could be anywhere. Our newsletter will keep track of where we are when we travel. So that should cover that. And I don't like pitching more than one thing anyway. So.
Well, I'll tell you what I'm going to do is I'm looking at the end of my questions and I'm going to write the word newsletter.
Mm-hmm.
So I can ask you about that at the, I don't know that it'll make the show, but, in terms of a question, but I know for a fact, it'll make as part of the introduction and then pitches into the breaks. So.
Thank you so much. Really appreciate that.
You ready? Ready?
I am ready.
Coming up in 3, 2. By the way, before I start, is it Chert Cow?
Oh, thanks for asking.
Yeah.
Not that I care, because my name is not quite as impossible as some.
Yeah.
But the last part I usually pronounce like K-O, Co.
Chert Co. Chert Co. Got it. Okay, here we go. On the phone with us, an author, Randy Chertko, who wrote an unbelievably monumental piece of work titled Making Money with Music. Randy, I read it, and thank you for coming on and spending an hour with us talking about this new book.
Happy to. Thank you so much for inviting me.
Oh, sure. Now, you wrote this with Jason, is it Feehan?
Yeah, that's right. Feehan.
Right. Now, if you, the audience, are looking for a book to help you out, and if you at all a listener to the Rock School Radio Show, you know that one of the things I scream about is how difficult it is to make it as a musician in this world. So, Randy, let me just start with an overriding question. I mean, the sell of digital world is tough because, I mean, everyone is doing it regardless of levels of talent or songwriting abilities and such. Can this still be done? Can you become a musician who makes a living at making music? Can it literally be done anymore?
That's a great question, and it's definitely something that we get very often. The answer is yes, but of course, it comes with all of the required work and effort that you'd have to put in to building any kind of business at all, not just specific to music. And music has some particularly interesting aspects in that you really do have a choice between, I like to say, trucks and campers to the left and cars to the right, because mm-hmm. You could actually have an entire music business that you make a living at where you have zero fans at all, no fans. Mm-hmm. And the way you do that, of course, is business to business. You're doing music licensing and royalties and everything along those lines. The other part of it is if you build the fan base, you've got to be willing to really cultivate that fan base, give them products that they want to enjoy, and stay in communication with them on a regular basis, which is a lot of work.
Isn't this something that the record companies used to do after they signed a group?
It is, although I really think they stopped doing it very much after the 90s, honestly. I mean, I think by the early 2000s, they were only focusing on a handful of really major, large acts. And for the most part from there, from actually the types of people that we interviewed, they waited until people generated their own income stream and fan base and said, hey, what if we took 2/3 of that income and then got you bigger distribution and more out of it? Which, I mean, a lot of people say no at that point because they're like, well, you're not giving me anything I'm not getting on my own.
Right.
So it's an interesting question at that point.
If you're talking about a 360 deal, which you do mention in your book, Making Money with Music, if that's what you're talking about, explain to everyone what a 360 deal is.
Well, it only usually makes sense if you understand what the pre-360 deals were, which was to only get the masters, and they would own the copyright to the masters, which was the sound recording copyright. There's another copyright that comes out of it that has a whole separate of income streams coming off of it called the composition copyright, or the PA, mm-hmm. performing arts copyright. We cover this in the book and talk about how each of those, if you think of them as a coat hook, you can hang an awful lot of income streams off of both of those. But the biggest ones tended to be hanging on only the masters. Well, because they're trying to get enough income in order to justify signing artists, they not only started to grab the income streams that came off of the composition, they also started to take some from touring, from your merchandise, from really advertising, all kinds of income streams that come off of your likeness and the fact that you're out there as a brand, in order to try and pull all the income they can from the artist. So mm-hmm. when you're signing one of those contracts, you're really giving away quite a bit that you would be developing. Now, they're doing this in return for developing your brand so that it has value in the first place. And so we're not going to say that it's always a bad deal. What we'll say is you really want to choose your business partner very carefully, and you want to make sure that it's a fair deal for you, considering how many options there are of building it yourself, which is the subject of the rest of the book, except for the tiny section you just talked about.
Right.
We really think that there's a lot of good opportunities for people to do that on their own.
And I like that about the book. Number one, I said at the beginning, it's a monumental piece. And the reason I said that is because it's written like a handbook, and I got from it this sort of unsaid but sort of implied idea that, look, this can be done by you now with the tools that are digitally available. You don't always need a record company to come run and save you. I mean, am I reading that correctly?
No, you are reading it correctly, and probably the more interesting part of it, and I think you might have noted it as you look at the beginning of the book, is that we do say that it's really important not to think that doing it yourself means doing it alone. That's one of the biggest misconceptions. It's actually one of the more poisonous ideas that we have out there as a musician, that just because we know how to play music, just because we perform well or can compose music, that we also know the business side of it, and that we can do it all around a kitchen table at home. Really, the very first thing you should do if you're serious about answering the question that you started this whole podcast with, which is, can you make it on your own? Can you make a living on your own? Is yes, but just like any small business or even medium-sized business, you need a team behind you to try and make it successful. So one of the first things you should do is bring on somebody to handle the management part. And it can be one of the artists that are in a band if you're doing it. Just keep in mind that some of their energy and time is going to be focusing on growing their business, finding new income streams, and building up that aspect of their business.
You mentioned, as I have seen numerous times on the internet, crowdfunding and crowdsourcing, and you gave the now almost, cliche is not the right word, but Amanda Palmer made $1 million. And you know what she did? But does anyone else, is crowdsourcing and, you know, the all the different give me 10 bucks and I'll give you a new song each week, do those things still seem viable to you?
Well, we have a part in the book where we talk about all the sources that you can get funding, and it's not just about crowdsourcing. But I think the more important question is, what do you need money for? And of course, anybody can come up with a long list of answers to that. But one of the very first things that we talk about in the book are how to start a music business for $0. Mm-hmm. We talk about all of the free things you can get, including free distribution. That means that you get streamed on all the streaming platforms, the major name streaming platforms. You get sold on all the places where you can sell your music for no money. What you'd be giving up in that case, of course, you're giving up something, is a slightly higher percentage of the money that goes into that comes out of the profits. But it comes to you for zero. There's no risk at that point. And once you get enough money to actually start funding it, you can turn around and do better options that will give you more of that percentage later. In fact, there's some sites out there that will let you switch models if you just pay them a subscription after switching it over. So the point is, and I'm asking this question in particular, is just like any business, you actually should lay out, well, what is it that I need money for really? Do I need to spend it on that really expensive social media campaign, or can I do that by hand? Once you actually know the money you need, you might find that the funding sources that we list in there might be enough to be able to get you started. And then you let the world tell you what's working for you and what to invest in based on what's really successful. And sometimes you can grow it based on the engine of basically income that comes in out of the normal activities that you do and grow it from there.
I'll tell you one of the suggestions you gave that hit me right between the eyes, because I think it's brilliant, is the idea of taking photos and capturing video whenever you do anything. It seems obvious, but it's one of those things that until you're told about it, I was in a little band for a short while, and we spent 4 hours in a studio. We paid for studio time. And we paid two people to come in with cameras and video cameras. And it was shocking to me that we got two fully made videos out of it and were able to play on social media forever. I just thought that was a great suggestion. Is that something you think we should do?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, one of the things that we sometimes forget as musicians is that the things that we do day to day, you're basically about to sit down at your desk in order to start doing some work at your studio, is not something that your fan ever sees. So I'm actually staring at my rack of instruments, which includes guitars and clarinets and saxophones and mm-hmm. all kinds of stuff. And even that rack of stuff is kind of interesting. I have a guitar sitting directly to my left in a guitar stand. So these things are actually things that speak to you as a musician. They let them behind the scenes. And if all you have to do is whip out your phone while somebody's about to record a part, you've actually captured something that's meaningful. I'll share just something really briefly. I was in one of the meetings that was sponsored by the producer's wing of the Grammy Association. They have these meetings from time to time. And they told stories about really, really famous albums that were made. And there's just a handful of pictures, but they used it to actually tell a story. Well, where do you tell the stories nowadays? It's not just something that you're just showing on a screen to a group of people. You can do that on the internet, and you can do it live as you go. So this is goes back to what we were talking about earlier. One more piece to it, which is what we were saying on, well, how is it that I build a music business? You can't make an album and disappear for 12 months and show up again and expect anybody to know who you are anymore. When today, most people are checking their news when they're just at a stoplight. You actually have to provide a steady stream of relevant stuff that people want to interact with. And I can't think of anything more authentic than showing them pictures of you producing the work that they're going to hear maybe in a month or two, or maybe in 6 months.
Right. You suggested earlier on in the interview, and also in your book, that at least a secondary person should be hired. And when I got to the section I'm talking about, I thought to myself, there's where you put your money. The fact that you create, I mean, we through social media have become these visual animals. Text just doesn't do it anymore. That is where you need to put your money.
Yeah. Oh, no, absolutely. Although I will note that, I mean, I always suggest, I'm going to suggest this throughout, as anytime I'm asked these types of questions, the very first version of everything that you do as a musician should be to try and find free options. Mm-hmm. And just give an experiment. One of my favorite little books is called Little Bets. And Little Bets talks about the fact of the importance of trying little tiny experiments against the world to see what works and what doesn't work. And the smallest bet you can make, of course, is free options. Well, if you've got more than one person in your band, all you have to do is have one of them grab their phone and remember to take the pictures at first. And then later, if you want to scale it up because you want higher quality, you can hire somebody if that's really catching on, if people like seeing those types of pictures.
You talk about copyright, and anyone who is a listener to the show knows that I scream about copyright. And I've had musicians say to me, look, I've looked into copyright. It costs X amount of dollars. It's nothing I want to do. It's nothing I want to spend money on. I'm just going to mail a copy to myself or what have you. So for a little section here, let me just ask you about two or three things in the section where you talk about law and ownership and such, because it's so easily batted away. You Yes. talk about copyright, ISRC codes, getting with a pro, getting ID3s. And again, to just a troubadour, a person with a guitar that's trying to make it, these things seem foreign. So talk Mm-hmm. copyright first.
Sure. Well, let me wrap that up into a slightly bigger discussion, but not much bigger, which is that before you release your music into the world, there are 14 registrations that we suggest that you make to the music, and two of them are copyright registrations. The reason why there's two is the reason we talked about earlier, which is that you have one copyright for the sound recording and one copyright for the composition or performing arts copyright, as it's called, or sometimes they call it, that's the songwriter or song copyright. The distinction between the two are not too important to an artist that's managing themselves, except the different royalty streams hook off of these. But the reason why we suggest doing these 14 registrations we list in the book before releasing your music is twofold. First of all, as it relates to copyright, you get a 3-month window after it's first made available to the public. And that's called publication as a legal term. What that means is rather fuzzy. But if you can just keep in mind that you should register it before it goes out, you can get both attorney's fees as well as the ability to get punitive damages. And it's also statutory. It makes it much easier to actually sue somebody for copyright. You don't have to show damages. You just have to show someone used your work. It actually makes it much easier to recover it. And if you're releasing a lot of music, you don't necessarily have to register them all. But if you're serious about promoting something and putting it out into the world, it's worth it spending that little bit of money. And remember, we're the ones who say don't spend any money unless you have to. Mm-hmm. The rest of the registrations that hook off of that are with your pro, your performing rights organization that pay you when your music is performed, mm-hmm. Your sound recording pro, which is something like Sound Exchange, which pays you when your music is streamed as opposed to when it's played out live. And the distinctions there are in the book. I won't get into it here.
Right.
And here's the thing to note about all these registrations, which just sounds like a terrible grind. If you put on that business hat that we talked about earlier, the fact that you need somebody who's focusing on income streams, that registration, that set of registrations, which you can do in a weekend, can do it in a matter of you know, just a few hours, really, mm-hmm. are good for the length of copyright, which is your entire life plus 70 years in the United States.
It's 70 and now.
Yeah, it is. I think
wow.
it's yes, 70. I believe it's 70, and you should always check the latest because they're always trying to do legislation to
thank you,
tweak
Disney.
Things. Yeah, thanks, Disney. It's really the reason why this is the case. But I don't want to get into copyright. Is such a dark hole that anytime we speak, if it gets on copyright, we can never leave it. But I want to close the door on it by saying this is a money question. And those 14 registrations will get you tons of royalty income streams worldwide. And remember, you're a worldwide artist the second you put your music out. Mm-hmm. And number two, you can actually, if you can prove that you're making a steady income stream for it, you can auction off a percentage of those royalties, and we have that in another part of the book, and get a lump sum advance from it. And you don't even have to give all of it away. You can
right.
give like 50% or 15%, mm-hmm. whatever you'd like to do. And that means that you're getting money that you would only have gotten after you're deceased. That means your estate and your grandchildren or whoever inherits your stuff would get it. You can pull that money back to today, but that's only if you can prove that you're getting income streams in the first place. So the time to do it is before you release your music into the world and put all of your heart and energy into trying to promote it and get people to hear it.
Right. Now, look, I read the whole book. And once again, it's called Making Money with Music. And it really is written like a handbook, which made it so nice and easy to read. But not trying to, you know, make you sort of roll your eyes, but I really thought at chapter 9 is where it began to sing. The nuts and bolts are out of the way, now let's make money. And so I'm going to ask you some questions that deal with me specifically. So let me give you a
sure.
situation. My wife, I have two albums myself, and, you know, I got a job, so if people take it, that's great. But my wife and I write a Christmas CD each year. And we spent all this money to turn it into CDs and such, and nobody wanted the CDs. We had it on a website. We didn't know what to do. So with your knowledge, walk me through it. If I make another Christmas album this year, which I have every intention of doing, how in the world do I distribute this so people want to or will listen to it?
That's a very good question.
Thank you.
So let's break it apart. Distribution doesn't make people want to hear it. It just makes it available for people to hear it. So mm-hmm. the other half of it is actually cultivating people who are really enjoying what you're putting out. We as musicians are entertainers, actually, in the end. We're entertainment. We're something that's very important to everybody in the world. It's something that they truly enjoy. But you actually need to develop and cultivate your own following of people who are excited each time you put out work. Now, we talk about this in the very last chapter, which is called Your Release Strategy. And part of the concept behind your release strategy as you're building your audience is continuing to release things that are of interest to them, which includes the pictures you were talking about earlier, your mm-hmm. production. And then as you release your music, you don't have to release it all as one big album. You could release it in a song at a time. You can do remixes. The point is you need to be active weekly, if you can, every week. And that doesn't mean you have to release a song a week. You can release a picture. You can release a new piece of merch. You can release a video. But you need to stay in front of them because it's about staying fresh. If you've been generating this stream of stuff that your fans are enjoying, that's one way to do it. And so all of this probably leads to the other part of the question, which is, well, what if I don't have a fan base in the first place?
Mm-hmm.
How do I get one? And that's always the toughest place to start, right? It's from a standing start. No one's heard of me yet. And there are actually quite a few techniques that you can do. In fact, it was the subject of the most recent articles we wrote for Electronic Musician, which was, how do I get publicity when no one's heard of me? How do I get my first fans when no one's heard of me?
Yeah.
And there's a short answer to that, and the long answer I don't think we have time for on the cast, but for the short version, you really have to start as narrow and targeted as possible. It is not a, even though Christmas music is really something that quite a few people enjoy, millions and millions and millions, you actually have to win over a very small percentage in order to try and pick up your music and use it as a seed to start your fan base. And there's lots of ways to do it. We have an entire chapter called Get Heard, which has, I think, 45 categories of places where you can get your music heard, not just distributed, but like get it in front of people and, you know, have people discover it and find it. But a lot of ways, it's actually about being as specific as possible about a group of people that you can reach and convince to try and look at your music. And I'll give you one example before we move on. Mm-hmm. We also have produced a Christmas album, actually a holiday album, or actually, as I like to call it, an unholiday album, because it's called Santa Doesn't Like You. And Santa Doesn't Like You has songs like Smoking the Mistletoe and Coed Naked Drunk Christmas Shopping and things like that.
I want to listen to that. Tree.
Oh, exactly. So like by me saying that, you're intrigued. Well, we actually get a lot of listens every year by people we've never heard of. And the question is, how? How do we get those listens? Well, we're not doing any marketing. We have titles that come up in searches when you search for Santa, where you see Santa Doesn't Like You, which is a song. It's like, okay, what the heck is this? We also have songs like that that were good. That particular one, although we're not a novelty band, that one Dr. Demento picked up and played. Wow. And so suddenly we reached a whole lot of people, and then they started to get interested in the rest of the album. And once they check out your album, of course, if you're releasing other things on your streaming platforms, then they discover the rest of you and they start to become followers. And if you marry that to what I just talked about before, which is that you're releasing stuff on a regular basis, and by stuff, I don't mean kill yourself. I mean a picture, a something every week, a piece of merch, anything that you remix, anything that you want, then you're starting to build your fan base and they'll start introducing other people to check it out.
Hmm. I'll tell you the one thing in the book, and it was sort of said and moved along, but it was one thing that jumped out at me, was that in terms of social media and promotion, all days are not created equal. I don't know why I expected, and it's just my thought process, that the weekends would be best for social media because people have it, but you suggested that Wednesday was the day to post because that's when most people sort of push it along.
Yeah, it's the hump day, and about 2 o'clock, people take a coffee break and they're like, ugh, I've had it this week. I'm just going to check my social media. It's a time where people are likely to reshare things. Those types of analysis, that's not a fixed time, although we gave that in the book. What you'll find is that people's patterns change. But what you want to do is feed your social media use and promotion into the way that people live their lives and the way that people are more apt to be in front of their either their computer or their phones and share it along. And so if you release the right content at the right times, you're more likely to be successful, and it's less effort on your part, because you don't have to share as often when you do that.
Hmm. On page 266, not that it means anything to the show, but on page 266, you start talking about advanced fan-based income. And, I've been to a few of these, but I don't know why it never occurred to me to do it. You talk about a pre-show, post-show. You talk about a house concert.
Yes.
These are things that I've been to a house concert. I went to a friend of mine's house, and she served drinks and hors d'oeuvres, and this guy with a guitar sat there and sang to us,
yep.
And then I purchased his stuff. So talk about a house concert, and then I'll sort of push you into pre-show, post-show stuff.
Sure, sure. So really briefly, house concerts are just what it sounds like. You're playing in someone's house. And there's a number of advantages to it. First of all, it's more intimate. People tend to sell very, very well in terms of merch and other types of items, just to skip it over to the business side of it. It's the reason why you'd want to do it. It's really popular with 35 and over, groups as well. So you're more likely, they're less likely to want to go to a club, but more likely you want to go to a friend's house to see a show. And the beautiful thing about that age group is that they have a lot more disposable income and they're more able to do it. So there's a lot of advantages to it. There's some other hidden ones that we might have mentioned in the book, but just to clarify it, we know of bands that have toured on the country and they actually did house concerts along the way at the cities that were in between two different tour dates. So the beautiful thing is some of those places will let you just stay in the house. They're actually thrilled to have the band there, which means that you can not only get paid, you can save in lodging. So it's mm-hmm. it's kind of a clever thing. That the thing that's the downside, of course, is that you don't have a hotel room in your own space. And it's further, probably one of the bigger issues is that you can really wear yourself out if you don't take breaks on a really intense tour. But it creates a lot of opportunities. In the book, I think we refer to another book that's very good for that kind of thing. And I'd recommend reading that section and just searching on house concerts if you're interested in doing it. But it can be a great way to make money. And it's actually part of, as you said, before we move on to the next topic of post-show and pre-show types of income streams that you can activate, it's just one example of a lot of examples of income streams you can make by hanging out with your fans. You can actually make money. And what I mean by that is some of your fans just want to hang out with you. So if you like playing video games, some of your fans will literally pay to play video games with you, and then you could stream it on Twitch. They actually like that kind of thing. And you can make that as part of your patronage, where it's like, well, if you donate $10 a month to me, if you're my Patreon for $20 a month, I will grab the first five people that answer every time I do one of these nights, and I'll get you on the schedule, and you get to play video games with me. And suddenly you're making $20 a month just because they get to hang out with you from time to time. And it's a good incentive because they like it. Now, that depends on your fan base. Not every musician likes video games, and not all your fans would like it. But if you have the right kind of fan base, that can work. Another type of fan base might like partying. So all you have to do is rent a bus, go on a pub crawl. You don't even have to play music. And some fans actually want to pay money to party with the band in their town. So it's just, there's the kind of options that are out there are pretty amazing. And if you have the fan base style, remember we talked about that at the beginning, you need to create experiences that fans want to pay for and make those available to them. And that's where you can open up a new income stream.
And I'll tell you, when I read that section, I understood the house concert. That to me seemed viable. But at what point in time does it move into looking like a money grab and the millennial mindset says, okay, you know, stop. I'm not giving you $4 to watch you breathe, that kind of thing. Or does it?
Well, see, that depends on the relationship. Well, A, it depends on your fans and what kind of fans you have. And number two, it depends on the relationship you have with those fans. It depends on what kind of artist you are. If you're writing very soulful things that you're performing that's very meaningful to you, and each performance tears you up inside and tears up your audience, and that's what they've come out for. If you say, and come party with me, it's not going to work. Mm-hmm. But a house concert's perfect. A house concert's utterly perfect for that kind of artist. Because then it's like, okay, come see me. There's only 15 people that can come. It's intimate. And I'm going to charge you. For that kind of artist that's like very heartfelt, you can actually book a very small venue but charge people a lot of money to be part of it.
Yeah.
And you're more likely that they're going to want that kind of intimate atmosphere. And now they're still paying for being with you, but they're doing it like you're playing in this case. So this is why it goes back to little bets. It's about trying to see what they like. If you do that kind of party bus, you're like, yeah, you're just trying to get money. I don't care about partying with you. And then it's like, okay, that's not going to work. There's one other thing to keep in mind related to this, and I'm really glad to have the space that you asked this follow-up question, which is that, okay, so over this huge amount of time that we've been writing about this music business space that we're in, this is our fourth book, we've researched so many ways to make money with music. We're up to... I think the count as of this podcast, as of today, is 304, for what it's worth. And we keep finding more all of the time.
Sure.
And we've grouped them. We've categorized them. And among the categories we use is the stage of the artist.
Mm-hmm.
So what do I mean by that? There's a stage where you're starting out, and no one's going to pay to hang out with you when you're starting out, because they've never heard of you. And then there's a stage where you're established. So maybe you've had a group of, you know, maybe you actually, every time you book, you get 100 people in the room. Well, now you can start getting people interested in partying with you, because you've got actually more of a fan base. And then there's kind of a professional stage. And the professional stage in the world is, do you get paid for it? You're a pro. Congratulations. The professional stage we're talking about is, would anybody pay you to show up at their opening, their restaurant opening? That's an appearance fee.
Right.
Would they pay you to do it? Because people will show up because you, famous people, you famous person, are there. And so each of these might actually come in at a later phase where it looks like a money grab when you're starting out. But if you're actually booking shows such that, you know, every time you do it, you're sold out, people actually really want to get near you. And that's where it leads nicely into the thing that you asked about before, which is pre and post show, if you want me to go into that.
The pre and post show, all I was thinking about was the Live Nation stuff.
Mm,
where,
yeah,
you know, I could spend $1,500 to shake hands with Eddie Van Halen and
buy
stuff at nice places. And I'm thinking to myself, I understand the Stones, the Who, Van Halen doing stuff like that. But really, this guy who is kind of popular in Austin, but you suggest that, yeah, you can do it.
Again, fan base and stage. You gotta match it up to your audience and match it up to your the place where you're at. The point is that you need to be aware of what these income streams are to know whether you should try and tap them yet and to try them out. It doesn't cost much to give a test on this kind of thing. Saying, hey, I'm opening it up so that you can pay to be there when I do a sound check. And that's an extra $10 ahead. And I only have, you know, what I would do if I were going to do that is I would make sure that I have the kind of draw where, like, people are actually showing up to my shows just because my name's on the bill.
Mm-hmm.
Anything less than you're still establishing your audience. But once you get to that point, you're like, charge $10 ahead. It's like, and I'm only letting 5 people in for this kind of thing. And you really don't want too many anyway. You're just doing a sound check. See if you can get an extra $50 out of a show. If that starts to work, you can start playing with those meet and greet or have dinner with the band, pre and post. And, you know, I'd add that there's a lot of things that you can do pre and post show that might be appropriate for different audiences. So even if they're not interested in hanging out with you, they may love the experience so much that they want a memento from it. And there are services, I believe one of them is called show.co, but we have it listed in the book on a number of services that mm-hmm. do this, that allow you to sell digital copies of the just completed show with the audio. And so you can actually capture them as they're walking out the door and excited as heck about it.
Right.
And so, yeah.
The Allman Brothers did that.
Uh-huh.
Right. That's brilliant.
It's available to every band. You don't have to be the Allman Brothers to sell a video or audio from post-show. You can even sell mementos. There's some, if you hit that stage that it makes sense, you can even sell the set lists that were on the ground that you just used. They actually want things that were on the stage at that point. But you have to do that at the appropriate time or else you end up looking kind of looks ridiculous if you're not at the right stage. Right.
Yeah. And I'm a collector. I mean, you can't see you can't see the studio I'm in right now, but there are picks and records and signatures and such. And I got to be honest with you. I mean, I grew up in Cleveland, so I saw a lot of places, a lot of bands at the Agora, which is really a small, intimate place. And I would have paid $10 to have their set list or the strings that were on their guitar and all that.
Yep. Your broken guitar strings are worth money. I mean, you heard it here.
Yeah. How about that? Hey, there was one thing you talked about in the book that, and let's remember, I'm a 54-year-old guy. when I was coming up through the 70s and the 80s, if your song was used in a commercial or in some corporate gig and all that, man, you were selling out, corporate BS, you're a sellout. You have a section that states, look, you know, you might as well sell to the people that want your music. And apparently times have changed.
They I hate to say it, but they did change a while ago. That kind of dropped away as being, I think a lot of that was tied to the image of what being, and I'm actually using the term specifically, a rock star is. Mm-hmm. And artists are no longer rock stars per se. It's not just rock. There's all kinds of music. And the truth is there's not the same persona that you're expected to have or that will necessarily turn fans off. Now, again, it depends on your artist. And we talk about persona. I'm not just throwing out a term here that just is sort of vague. We're actually really specific in the book, as mm-hmm. you know, about what we mean when we say persona and what it is that you develop. And to describe it in just a handful of words, your persona is the perception that people carry around in their heads of who you are and what you are. And to the extent that your persona matches their identity is the extent that you're really going to have a fan or a super fan. Mm-hmm. or anything more even. So when it all comes together, if the persona is of I'm anti-establishment, anti-corporate, is just one of quite a few. For the most part, what we found is that most artists nowadays, it doesn't matter, and most fans are happy when their favorite artist actually gets something that's used in media and used in advertising or something like that.
Right.
I would just like to note that your music, there's four types of music supervisors, more generically. There's probably more than that, but there's four types that we talk about in the book. And so what you're talking about right now is music licensing, which we have a whole chapter on royalties and licensing. And the four types, that's just one of them. That's the advertising music supervisor. And what they're trying to do is find the exact right music to match the mood and feel that they want to use to highlight their product and sell it.
Mm-hmm.
The other three types, it's interesting, but nobody seems to talk about that being a huge issue. One of them is movies. And so it's like, well, you're selling out, you're in a movie. It's like, no, that's expected. It's part of the art. Same with television. That's another type of music supervisor. And the fourth type, surprisingly, is movie trailers. Movie trailers are separate than the movie supervisors. And the reason is, it's a different set of licensing needs, but what a supervisor for a trailer wants are the exact right hit and little bit of music for that little part of the ad. And those ads actually have a certain set of beginning, middle, and end. They actually have little beats that they hit. It's very, very exacting science. So what they want is they want your song, but they're probably going to chop it up into bits. And so if you're not happy with that and you want it to stay integrity, you want it to stay the way it is, then don't license to them. But otherwise, feel free to give them your stems and say, chop it up, I'll take the money.
Yeah.
And they'll use it. And so the point being, like, each of these things are using it for different purposes and different needs. And again, it depends on your persona and your audience. Are you going to turn them off by doing it? Or will they not care? Or will they be happy for you?
Yeah.
Anyway, it's yet another set of income streams, quite a few income streams that you can turn on for your music, which doesn't detract from streaming, like your fans streaming it or playing it live or getting royalties, the fact that it's getting played on the radio. And I'll just tie this to the higher concept that really is at the heart of our book, which is that in order to succeed at music, it's not just about starting a music business singular. It's about setting up many, many different income streams. Some of them are irregular and inconsistent. Some of them are consistent. Some of them are active, meaning you don't get paid if you're not playing right now, like a live show. And some of them are passive. People could be streaming our music right now because they checked out Santa Doesn't Like You, and I'm making a little bit of money on that, even though I've did this podcast and it's already in the can. And, you know, it's something that people heard a year from now. So all of these things are ways to build your business off of a whole sets of these income streams in order to try and make it successful.
You mentioned in your last answer and also in the book, you pitch radio. Now, I'm an old radio guy. I started doing my first shows when I was 17. And today it's so easy for a millennial or a person, you know, who's in their teens to sort of poo-poo radio and just, oh, it's a dying medium and all that. But you pitch it. Do you still consider radio a method of getting your music out there?
Well, let's pan back the camera. The chapter that you're talking about is called Get Heard and Seen. And one of the things that we found was that, first of all, if you look back one book, we actually mentioned radio as one big thing and college radio as one big thing. And we realized there were actually aspects of radio that are within reach, even in the musicians that are in the startup or established phase, not just the professional one. Mm-hmm. Now, noting that commercial radio is still bought and paid for, it's really something that's quite expensive to do in the order of six figures or more. It's generally not a good target. But also noting that college radio is well within your reach, public radio is well within your reach, syndicated shows are well within your reach, and studio appearances, especially in college radio, are a great way to start promoting things and to get your stuff out. These all help you reach new listeners. And you might be thinking along these lines, which is, okay, I'm going to do all this work and I'm going to get played on college radio. What does that actually mean for developing a fan base? It's very hard just off of one mechanism to build your fan base, but what you use it for afterwards is even more important. It's just like that broken guitar string, which you can later sell for $10 and you're like, oh, wow. And what do you know? That thing that I played on and I got some money out of that because I played a show, I can actually make a little more on it. But what you get out of every play that you can get in all those categories and ways to get heard and seen is that I usually bring it across, although you can ladder up. I'll talk about this in a second. You can either ladder up or bring it across. But bring it across means I'll bring it across to my publicity or marketing campaign and said, I was just played on NPR. Would you like to, that article that you were ignoring before, would you like to check me out now? And suddenly somebody who wasn't even paying attention to you is like, oh, you were just played on NPR. All right. All right. I'll check this out. And then as soon as you get that story, you bring that sideways again. And you're like, you go to a slightly bigger radio station and like, hey, I was played on NPR and this guy wrote this review. You want to check out my album finally and start to play it. And the ladder up is exactly what I'm starting to talk about where, okay, now you got that one thing. What's the next bigger thing that the fact that you got the smaller thing can get you to? Well, why are you doing the smaller things? It's a ladder. You don't go try and get four rungs up. You grab the next one, the one that's in reach. The whole thing on our book is you always do things that are within arm's reach, and you do it on things that don't cost anything if you can. And most of the Get Heard campaigns, including getting on the radio on syndicated shows, it's just about sending it into a submission link, and if you get it, then awesome, you can leverage it into something else. College radio, not hard. The students are the ones who run the show. They're thrilled to be reached out to because they're college students, and it usually doesn't take much to get a play out of it, and then use that to leverage your way higher and bigger and broader.
As you said in the book, and I'm just going to go ahead and quote you, public relations, you just said PR, but public relations is a crock pot, not a microwave. No such thing as an overnight sensation, man.
Yes.
It's true, isn't it? Okay, look, last question.
Yes.
In terms of all of this, you knock yourself out, you do all the things. Isn't there at all points in time an element of luck stuck right in the middle of it?
Well, of course. But what's the definition of luck? It's opportunity meets preparation.
Yeah. The more I work, the luckier I get.
Right. Yeah. And so it's okay, I had an opportunity, but so what? I mean, did you take advantage of it? The opportunity comes knocking all the time. I hate cliches. I actually work as hard as I can to keep them out of the book. Jason keeps adding them, but I'm making fun of him because he couldn't be here on this podcast, so he has to deal with it. But, you know, if you hear that knock, you know, did you open the door? And you probably have had a lot of things like that. So what I mean by that is this. Okay, you got played on NPR, or you got some radio show to pick you up. How many artists are there that gave up after they got some successes? Well, part of what's missing is the strategy that we were talking about just a few minutes ago of laddering or snowballing. Sometimes we call it snowballing and laddering. Mm-hmm. And so what Jason and I have always done for everything that we do that's publicly related is that when we get a success, we always tout that success elsewhere. And it's not about beating our chest and saying we're so awesome. It's, hey, other people like what we're doing. Maybe you'll be interested too. It's social proof, and it's psychology, which we even talk about in different points in the book. Is, and in fact, you even brought it up when you were talking about the social media campaign. I may as well do it in a way that people actually work. Well, when do people pay attention to something? When they're hearing about it in other places. And this is a technique that was, I think, in the zone of the PR is a crockpot, not a microwave section, is that people are more likely to pay attention to something when there's other social proof out there, and it's called borrowed credibility. Mm-hmm. Is, you've never heard of me, but you've heard of NPR, and NPR has played our music, by the way. And as soon as I say NPR's played our music, you're like, oh, well, maybe you're worth checking out. Whereas if I just say my band name and no one's heard of me, no one will pay any attention. So the point is, like, each success that you get, even small ones, are things that can start keep building you up. And so this luck thing, of course, it's a factor. Of course, of course, of course. But the thing that we have that we didn't have as much of in the past that's really in our favor as it comes to luck is that once that kind of luck triggers, you can get a lot out of it. And I just want to say one brief thing about that to give an example. There are some video channels that go viral because somebody pays attention to it, and the channels then die off, but you have that one video. Others get tons of subscribers and tons of followers. What's the difference between ones that do that and ones that don't is that if you have other content and other stuff that people want to pay attention to on it that match what they expect, that's when you're sustainable. When you have just one thing and you don't have anything to hang it on and you haven't been building that, that's when it won't stick. So that's what you're trying to build towards. Hmm. Hopefully that helps answer that question.
The name of the book, once again, is Making Money with Music. And I'm not just doing this because I have this podcast and it's my job to sell a book. I honestly enjoyed this thing front to back. It's by Randy Chertko and Jason Feehan. And it's my opinion, if you have a musician in your life, if you are a musician, it would be a good couple of bucks for you to look at. However, it goes on because I believe you've started a newsletter. Can you pass that out to us?
Yes, absolutely. We started the Making Money with Music newsletter because in spite of the many newsletters that I am part of, including keeping track of the news and keeping track of ideas on how to promote, I haven't found a newsletter that's just focused, laser focused, on just making money. As I said, we have 300 plus ways to make money with music. And as big as that book is, which is 126,000 words, we ran out of words, literally. I have like two more books worth of stuff and no place to put it. So we had to start our newsletter. It's makingmoneywithmusic.com. It's just like the book title, and you should be able to search it to find it. If you go to /newsletter, you can find it, but you'll find it right on the front page. It will hit you and say, subscribe to the newsletter today, and you can join. And it's free. And we're going to be doing it every 2 weeks. We're going to constantly be putting stuff out. And as a result of signing up, you'll actually get what we call our Making Money with Music companion PDF, which starts out by giving you the 21 categories of all those 300-plus ways. We've categorized them in the 21 categories of places, ways to make money. Those categories are really a good place to start so that you have the overall picture. And we had to make that companion just so that as we're giving you these pieces of advice, you can fit it into a broader framework. You don't have to have read the book to join the newsletter, and it's entirely separate.
Randy, thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me. This was an utter pleasure. Your questions were just so on target, and I really hope that everybody listening can start applying it and really starting their engine and really ramping that up to try and make more money with music. So, thanks.
And I hope they use the book. That'd be wonderful. Thank you so much.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Okay, man, stay with me.